The following is a rebroadcast of Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Joe Moore. On today's program, is the Central Valley the last refuge of the California dream? LA-based columnist Joe Matthews thinks so. He'll join us. He's urging young coastal Californians to ditch the high-rent neighborhoods and clogged freeways and look to cities like Fresno and Visalia for the future. We'll also find out what's eating the Delta smelt and talk about mental health in the Valley. We'll get some answers as to why local counties have the highest rates of mental illness in the state and learn what can be done about it. Later in our program, we'll talk with Selma's Victor Davis Hanson. You may know him as a conservative political columnist, but he's also one of the world's top military historians. We'll talk about his new book on generals who turned around wars that were all but lost. But first, have you been short on money? Maybe you've considered using one of those payday loan stores that are seemingly on every street corner in the Valley. In 2011, 1.7 million Californians used payday loans, accounting for over $3 billion in lending. But some cities, like San Jose, have decided to crack down on the practice. And a group in Fresno wants to do the same. Valley Public Radio's Ezra Romero reports.
Josie De La Fuente and her 30-year-old son live in a small two-bedroom apartment in southeast Fresno.
What'd you do today at work?
I don't know. What do you mean you don't know?
I tell him that and he tells me, I don't know.
Just over a year ago, she joined the ranks of the thousands who turned to short-term, high-interest loans to make ends meet. She says taking out a payday loan ensnared her.
Imagine me, you know, getting a payday loan, paying a $300 loan with all the other bills that I have. You know, the car payment, the apartment, the rent, and all that stuff. You know, I'm not going to have any money left, you know, with all that.
Just under 12 million Americans use payday loans each year to cover gaps in expenses and to pay for unexpected emergencies. Here's how it works. A borrower can walk into a loan store with a check and a pay stub and get a loan for, say, $250. They give the lender a check for $300 dated for their next payday. In De La Fuente's case, she was able to pay off her loans on time, but many consumers don't or can't. Not only do they face potential overdraft fees, but also additional interest if they choose to renew their loans for another month, continuing the cycle.
I don't recommend it to anybody. It's a situation that we get ourselves into that sometimes that you think that there's not a way out, but there is a way out.
According to a new Pew Research Center study, researchers found that only 14% of borrowers can afford enough out of their monthly budgets to repay an average payday loan of $400. And 27% of payday loan customers wind up with bank account overdraft fees. It's an issue that's drawn the attention of Faith and Community, a Fresno-based group of religious leaders who say the city has too many loan sharks that unfairly target low-income communities, trapping people in a cycle of debt. Andy Levine is the group's director.
We're okay with payday lenders operating. They fill a need, but 459% APR is absolutely unacceptable and immoral.
Levine's group is urging the Fresno City Council to cap the number of payday lenders in the city at 67.
We realize that's going to take a lot of organizing, a lot of pressure, especially given how powerful the payday lobby is.
The group has been working with council member Oliver Baines to bring the issue of payday lending before the council in the coming months. Baines declined to comment on this story. For many, it's an issue about social justice. Pastor Paul Binion of Westside Church of God in West Fresno says payday lenders prey on people of limited resources and education. He says members of his congregation continually deal with payday loans.
You know, we call them predators. They take advantage of poor people, those who feel they have no other options, and, you know, their mission is not to help or to assist, but to take advantage of and to profiteer.
But those in the payday industry disagree. They say they're providing a needed resource.
Payday lending is just one legitimate state-regulated option for people who have bank accounts to access a small amount of cash for a short period of time. The vast majority of payday lending customers, like with almost every other financial product, they use the product responsibly, they pay it back on time, and they're done with the product as intended.
That was Greg Larson, spokesman for the California Financial Service Providers Association. Jamie Fulmer, Senior Vice President of Public Affairs with Advance America, one of the nation's largest payday lending groups, says payday lenders are misunderstood.
I think there are a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings about the products and services that we offer by the general public, but by a segment of our population, the hardworking middle-income consumer, there is a very clear understanding of the value that we provide.
Della Fuente says the service was useful, but it was outweighed by the stress it brought her.
It helps me in some way, and in some way it doesn't, because in some way I'm giving people money that money I should be keeping for myself. That's the way I see it. If I would have continued going that way, I would always be like that. My life, I won't be able to change it.
Della Fuente's pastor suggested she get involved with the Center for Community Transformation at Fresno Pacific Seminary. The group's goal is to educate churches and their congregations in financial literacy. It was at this institute that Della Fuente learned how to manage her finances. Andrew File, a pastor at the Well Community Church in Fresno, mentored Della Fuente throughout her course.
Josie had a $75 bill still on her payday loan, and she was able to pay that off. She brought in the receipt to the class. We got to cheer her on and got to hear her say, I'm never going to use these things again.
Della Fuente says that learning the basics about personal financial management has changed the way she sees money.
It was something that I needed to show for myself that I can do it, because once you get hooked on something and you just keep on and keep on and keep on and you never stop.
Both payday lenders and advocates agree. The best way for people to avoid using payday lenders is to learn how to manage their finances and to only use lenders as a last, well-thought-out resort. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. For decades, millions of fish have been diverted from pumping facilities at state and federal water projects in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. Fish, including endangered species like the Delta smelt, are put in holding tanks, then trucked to other parts of the Delta and released. From there, little is known about their fate. But most scientists agree it's not good. As Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, predator fish often wait for what amounts to a daily feeding.
Imagine you're an endangered Delta smelt. You're not quite 3 inches long, you can't swim very well, so you mainly ride on the current. That current could take you to the not-so-quiet Skinner Fish facilities in Tracy. From there, you flow through pipes and into an 1,100-gallon holding tank. Jim Odom with the California Department of Water Resources runs those facilities.
That's our whole intent, is to salvage all those small fish before they get into the system so they get lost and never can return.
The system is the State Water Project, where water from the Delta is pumped to Central and Southern California. After being counted, a mechanical bucket loads you, the lowly smelt, and all kinds of other fish into a tanker truck. Some of those other fish may be hungry.
The longer we keep them in captivity, the more chance they have of perishing or being eaten up by some of the other predators that we're salvaging. We salvage everything that comes through the system, gets loaded up here, and hauled back.
Your tanker truck then travels to Sherman Island and backs up to one of two release sites. A big pipe shoots you and all those other fish 50 feet out into the water. And if you survive that process, which isn't likely, death may await you at the end of the pipe.
And basically, the predators would really sit within a couple feet of that pipe waiting for fish to come out.
That's awful. Javier Miranda is an environmental scientist with the Department of Water Resources. A few years ago, as part of a predation study, he lowered a sonar camera into the murky Delta waters to find out exactly what was going on.
We thought there might be a kind of a dinner bell effect where when they heard the truck drive up, they'd all come up to the site.
Like Pavlov's fish, salivating.
As it turned out, when the predators were there, they were always there. They were waiting.
Largemouth bass, striped bass, Sacramento pike minnow, and other predators await most of the salvaged fish.
We can see fish kind of coming out of the pipe, and you would see On a good day, you would see them kind of swim off, and other days when there was predators there, you would see a few get picked off.
The study also showed the predators were seasonal, showing up in the summer months when tens of thousands of fish would be released on any given day. But if you're a smelt, there is some good news.
One of the good things we saw from our studies was that during the months where we had endangered species, so Delta smelt, salmon, we didn't see a lot of predators at those sites.
It's still not a good fate for most salvage fish. Brent Bridges is a fish biologist at the Tracy Fish Facilities, part of the Bureau of Reclamation's Central Valley Project. They have the same problem at their release sites. Bridges says they're now trying to trick the predators by turning on and off the pumps at the release sites.
And the idea is we want to prevent the fish, the predators, from realizing they're going to be fed, because we just don't want them to learn that when they hear the pump running, they're going to get fed.
Bridges says biologists don't know whether the predation at the release sites is actually affecting fish populations in the Delta. But he says both the state and the federal water projects are building more release sites so they can use a different site every day of the week. Javier Miranda says studies show in the Delta, predation is high and survival is low.
And so it's kind of a trade-off of predation in the river or predation in our salvage process. Unfortunately, the science is just kind of getting caught up right now in terms of what's better, is it versus river or salvage. But you could ask a lot of people and they'd say it's better to have those fish go through the salvage process.
For salmon, the salvage process is a shortcut through the Delta and out to the ocean. But if you're a fragile smelt, the forces are against you, even if you make it to that holding tank. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
According to a new study of mental health throughout the state, the San Joaquin Valley has the highest rate of mental illness in California, affecting over 1 in 20 adults and 1 in 12 children. At the same time, the Valley has the lowest number of mental health professionals in the state. Here to tell us more about this research is Neil Adams. He is the Deputy Director of the California Institute for Mental Health. And we're also joined by Sandra Shuri of the nonprofit California Healthcare Foundation. CHCF is a supporter of Valley Public Radio, we should add. Sandra, welcome.
Thank you.
Neil, this isn't the first time we've heard stories about the geographic disparities in healthcare and health outcomes in California. But this is very interesting data that's come out of the study. What can you perhaps attribute this to?
Well, I think for a long time there's been an understanding that there's a linkage between poverty and mental illness. In the old days, we understood mental illness differently, and we talked about the downward drift in socioeconomic status that people who had serious mental illnesses would experience. I think we've gotten smarter about that and recognize that, yes, there's an association between poverty and mental illness, but it's probably more in the direction of poverty being a stressor that brings about or precipitates the onset of mental illness and the persistence of mental illness rather than it being a result of mental illness. I mean, I'm sure there's some of both, but I think in terms of trying to understand the data from this study, that's the best approach. I also want to make sure that when we talk about mental illness in this context, we're talking about serious mental illness for adults and what we call SED or serious emotional disturbances for children. And so we're looking beyond the transient or self-limiting problems that people have where they may experience some psychiatric or symptoms, emotional distress related to the stress and strain of everyday life, not to diminish those or their significance, but we're really looking at those mental illnesses that impact people's ability to function in a day-in, day-out basis.
Statewide serious mental illness affects about 4.3% of Californians. In the Valley, those numbers are around 5, 6, 7%, depending on the county that you choose to look at. Sandra, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on why we see these numbers so high in this part of the state.
Some people think people move to more rural areas or go back to family if they're experiencing a mental illness and not being treated. One of the big takeaways from our study is so much mental illness does not get treated. Half of adults and two-thirds of adolescents with mental health needs just don't get treatment.
Speaking of treatment, there's a lot of different approaches to mental health treatment, a lot of different types of mental health treatment. Is there a disparity also in the types of treatment afforded, the types of funding that are applied to different sorts of treatment throughout the state?
Well, the way it works in California is while most of the money is provided by the state government, counties are given the responsibility to set up the delivery system. So each county tries to put together a network of either county-funded clinics or contracts with private providers to provide services for people needing mental health care. Because the way it's set up, each county is doing it on their own, making their own decisions, you do get a little bit of difference. Clearly, some of the counties where there are a lot of mental health professionals living tends to be the coastal areas in our state. Greater access to services, bigger challenges you see in places like the Central Valley or rural Northern California.
Turning back to Neil now, this issue of the shortage of mental health professionals in the Valley, does this, in your opinion, help to fuel a cyclical cycle here that we aren't treating these cases and we also have these other geographic stressors that are also a part of these numbers?
Well, I'm sure there's some correlation, and what we've seen nationally and known for many years is that the problem with the mental health workforce is not just simply a matter of adequacy, or, you know, do we have enough people and are they competent, do they have the right skills, but also how are they distributed geographically. And what you see, particularly as a psychiatrist, I'm familiar with the data on psychiatry, is that psychiatrists tend to gravitate to the coasts and also to larger cities. And I think you see that reflected in the data that's in the Almanac in terms of where do we have more psychiatrists and where we have fewer.
There's been a lot of discussion about the expansion of coverage that is we're about to embark upon with the Affordable Care Act and the provisions that kick in January, enrollment that's going to begin in just months. That's expansion of coverage. Expansion of care is a different issue, or access to care is a different issue. And with the shortages that we have of mental health professionals in this part of the state, is there anything we could be doing better knowing that we have this shortage of professionals in that area?
We can and should, and if I may say so, must, improve the integration of mental health services into the primary care setting. I personally think that there's a very important and unique role for what I'll call specialty mental health, and that's traditionally what the counties have done. They've provided psychiatric services and psychiatric rehabilitation to people with serious mental illnesses, the folks we talked about before who have functional impairments as a result of a mental illness. But it's made it harder in some ways for folks who have less severe illness to get the treatments that they need. And oftentimes they turn to the primary care setting, but the primary care folks have not necessarily been adequately staffed or prepared or trained to provide as much mental health service as needed and appropriate to provide in that primary care setting. So there are a number of initiatives that are underway around the state, including the Central Valley, that have looked at promoting primary care and mental health integration. And many counties, and I'm aware of a project particularly in Merced County as an example, where there's been a real effort to get staff who've traditionally worked in the county mental health system into the federally qualified health centers and the community health clinics in order to address these issues.
Sandra, before we go, one last question. In addition to the Affordable Care Act, there's another law that's out there that's also making a big impact on how we provide mental health services. Tell us about that.
The parity laws were passed in 2008 at the national level. What they say is, if you get insurance from your employer and that insurance covers mental health, then it has to cover mental health the same way it covers physical health. You can't have lesser day limits, a dollar cap on the mental health care coverage. Instead, it has to be what's called at parity. So if there's no dollar limit on hospitalization, then there's no dollar limit on it, whether it be for mental health or for physical health. So that's a huge change that's been being implemented over the last 5 years. We just saw the state issue some very large fines on a health insurer for not complying fully with that law. So you're starting to see that really take hold.
We've been talking about mental illness in the San Joaquin Valley and a new study that came out just days ago that indicates the Valley has the highest rates of mental illness in the state. Our guests today, Sandra Shuri with the nonprofit California Healthcare Foundation and Neil Adams with the California Institute for Mental Health. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay with us in just a moment. We'll be back with Selma's Victor Davis Hanson. You may know him as a conservative political columnist, but he's also one of the world's top military historians. He has a new book that he calls The Savior Generals. We'll talk about that and more coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. How do some military leaders take wars that have been all but lost and salvage victory? What do these great commanders have in common, and what can they teach us about military history and leadership? That's the question posed in a new book by our next guest, Selma's Victor Davis Hanson. He's one of the nation's leading military historians and classicists. He's also a noted conservative commentator and a fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University. His new book, The Savior Generals, How Five Great Commanders Saved Wars That Were Lost, was published earlier this year. Victor, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
And in the interest of disclosure, I should note that I was once one of Professor Hanson's students in ancient Greek when he taught at Fresno State, though I should also add I was not one of his better students. So
you were a good student.
Victor, this new book is really interesting in the way that you look at generals throughout history, throughout the Western tradition. And I guess one could say that it's a strong defense of the great man theory of history?
Yes, I think so. In contemporary times, with the advent of globalization and high tech, we feel that people have receded to the background. And it's a timely reminder that it's not just David Petraeus that made this surge possible, but it's also, in recent times, a guy like Matthew Ridgway. Without Matthew Ridgway, I think we would have lost the Korean War. It's not true of all wars or all situations, but take a Steve Jobs away from Apple, and I don't think it would be where it is today, or Bill Gates up from Microsoft. So there's a combination of larger cosmic forces, but we've got to remind ourselves that people do matter.
You're looking at a number of generals that one normally wouldn't put together in the same grouping, everyone from the ancient Greek Themistocles to William Tecumseh Sherman to someone who's not necessarily a household name with Ridgway. You described them as mavericks and loners. What did you mean by that, and how do you see that they all fit into that?
Well, I surveyed 2,500 years of history, and there's 20 or 30 wars that were deemed lost. But I was interested in wars that, by any stretch of the imagination, could not have been won had one person not arrived at the 11th hour. In the case of Belisarius, the Byzantine general, or Ridgway in Korea, Sherman had not taken Atlanta on September 2, 1864. It's pretty clear Lincoln would not have been reelected. Had he not been reelected, the United States, as we know it, would probably not exist. So what were the commonalities across time and space that all these generals seemed to share? And one of them was contrarianism. They were difficult people in peace, and they ended up in the post-war period as difficult as they were before their moment of decision. They also were very well read. They were erudite. They studied situations. They were very distrustful of popular opinion. If 51% of the people felt that the surge, in the case of the surge, actually it was more like 70, Petraeus thought that was a good indication to suggest it was not lost. If Ridgway was told that American people did not think they could defeat the so-called Chinese supermen and they were on the verge of taking Seoul again, 1951, he was convinced that the same situation that had caused the setbacks for America could be reversed and would cause problems for the Chinese. So they thought out of the box. They thought that people being sheep-like, herd-like, a good leader could not trust what most people felt. They had enormous confidence in their abilities to write and speak well. They had a tragic sense that they were going to be with their men, and if something happened to them, the dangers of their own loss or being killed or severely wounded on the front lines was not as great as the dangers of having their men think that they were not being led from the front or that their commanders were somehow not exposing themselves to the same dangers that the average men in the ranks did.
There's a lot of books about great generals. It's easy to look on the shelves of a library or a bookstore and find tomes about Hatton, about Napoleon, about Cortez. This is different. We talk about great generals. These five that you look at are great generals, but is there something beyond that that you see?
Well, that's a good point. In the 19th century especially, there were these corpus of books, the great commanders, the great captains, and you know they start with Alexander, they go to Caesar, they include Hannibal, Napoleon, Wellington. But on all of these cases, they're parts of larger systems, superior technology, superior manpower, superior military tradition. I wanted to turn that on its head and look at situations where none of that mattered. The United States may be the greatest military power in the world, but in the end of 2006, it was going to lose in Iraq, and nobody wanted anything to do with Iraq, both the public and the military. So I was trying to find situations in which they were completely written off. When Themistocles took command at Salamis, Athens didn't exist. It was burned down and occupied by the Persians. When Sherman was asked to take the Army of the West and head to Atlanta, Ulysses S. Grant literally ruined the Army of the Potomac in horrendous places like Cold Harbor, the Wilderness, Petersburg, Spotsylvania, suffering almost 100,000 casualties in that terrible summer of 1864. And the people had completely turned not just on Grant but on Lincoln himself. So I was trying to find situations where there were no other criteria except the exceptional nature of the commander. And I wish I could say they all ended up well, but they all ended up poorly, perhaps because they had a lot of character flaws. They were outspoken. They were sort of like the Western archetype that we so often appreciate in the film genres of the 1940s, 1950s, Shane, High Noon, The Searchers, The Magnificent Seven, where we have an individual comes on the scene, the situation is lost, they can't find somebody, or the enemy has taken over the town, or the bad guys are on the noon train, and then one person defeats them. And then after he defeats them, there's no place in society left for them, or that they've done their great achievement, or they don't like this, the peacetime protocols or the business as usual, and they don't do well. The irony is that after I had sent the manuscript in November of 2012, an editor had remarked that Petraeus was the exception to that rule, that he would end up as CIA – he ended up as CIA director, and then suddenly all his problems broke on the scene. So I think that was predictable rather than surprising.
Is there anything common that you see in the rise of these individuals? Obviously, they're coming to the fore in a time of great turmoil, wars that – by the very definition of your thesis, were all but lost. But these are individuals that were not necessarily primed to the top rung of leadership before.
They all, I don't know if we call them narcissists, but if you or I had the career setbacks that they had, we would be very depressed about it. But they all thought they had a sense of destiny. They were all critical of people who had been very much more successful than they were. But I think most importantly is they were students, very well read, very well spoken, and they had this belief in themselves. They thought, you know, people are not being empirical. Our command in Korea is not looking at the evidence that the Chinese are now 400 miles from the Yalu River and they're in the same vulnerable logistic situation that we were just 3 months ago and when we thought we had won the war. Or Petraeus would say, if you look at the situation empirically, we have killed a lot of jihadists from 2003 to 2006. There's an Anbar awakening. They're just about ready to break. Nobody in his right mind would have thought that, given the polls that said 70% of Americans wanted out of Iraq. Sherman said, I know that Atlanta is much further from northern lines in Tennessee than is Richmond from Washington. I know that Joe Johnson is a skilled commander, but I can get the greater distance to Atlanta before Grant can get to Richmond, even though Grant was the hero of the times, hero of Vicksburg and Shiloh, etc. But they had a sense of destiny, of confidence in their own power.
Our guest today on Valley Edition is Selma's Victor Davis Hanson. His new book is called The Savior Generals, How Five Great Commanders Saved Wars That Were Lost. You've had the opportunity to teach at the U.S. Naval Academy. Are there any lessons that we can apply from these generals to the future, to the next generation?
Yeah, I think so. I think that what I'm worried about in our high-tech, big government society, that we trust too much in bureaucracies and we get company people both in the corporate world, in the administrative state, in the university, in big government. And we, when people are brash, when they're outspoken, when they have different ideas, they run afoul of particular codes of behavior. We have no leeway to allow eccentricity to express itself. And if you look at our great generals of the last 10 years, there's at least four of them. James Mattis, the very decorated Marine four-star general that was CENTCOM commander, he stepped down early, 2 years early, because he got in a dispute with the Obama administration about some comments he made about the Iranian danger. We know about the problems David Petraeus had when he ran afoul. General Allen, that I knew very well at the Naval Academy when I was teaching there, he was a brilliant commander. He was indiscreet in some emails. And, of course, Stanley McChrystal, who said some things he should not have to a Rolling Stone reporter. The point I'm making is that all four of our top combat generals of this generation are now not there to help us, and not because of any lapse on the battlefield. If anybody was empirically minded and looked at their actual campaign record, that was superb. But because of the sophisticated bureaucratic state, the rules of conduct, of speech, they didn't fit too well. And yet, believe me, when we're in Iraq, we do not want a George Casey or a Tommy Franks or Ricardo Sanchez as the top guy. We want a Petraeus. We do not want a General Walker or even a MacArthur. We want a Ridgway in Korea, and we don't want a Rosecrans. We don't want a Burnside. We don't want a McClellan. We don't want a Hooker. We don't want a Halleck, company men on their way to Atlanta. We want a guy like Sherman. But we have to be very careful that we establish a leeway or some tolerance for eccentricity and contrarianism and flamboyance.
These generals you're writing about are all from the Western tradition, and I could see some people saying, well, why not someone from outside the Western tradition?
Well, there's a person could argue there were great Chinese commanders in the Persian Empire. The expansion under Darius and Xerxes especially, there were gifted commanders. But there's two reasons why I focused on the West. Whether we like it or not, the historical record is much more complete both in antiquity and in the present. By that I mean if we're talking about Themistocles, we have the rich histories of Herodotus, Plutarch's Lives, Diodorus. If we want to talk about Xerxes or Darius, there's nothing there other than what's in the Western tradition. There's no idea of history that exists in the Persian Empire. If we want to talk about the Korean War, we have open, transparent archives. We still do not have a candid and transparent narrative tradition coming out from the Chinese Red Army. And so part of it is the nature of the sources. That's important. And then the other element that I focused on is there's a greater degree of consensuality. By that I mean that these people functioned, even Belisarius, within a constitutional framework, which meant that public opinion could express itself, which meant that often the wars were felt to be lost not by a king or a tyrant but by the people. And so these generals had to deal with public opinion in a way an autocrat, Suleiman the Great in Istanbul didn't. And that makes it a very different experience.
Throughout a number of books, you've offered a vigorous defense not only for Western warfare tradition but also for Western society and culture. Last week or so, we saw a new poll out talking about Americans' perceptions of the rise of China as a superpower about to eclipse the United States. Neil Ferguson has a new book talking about the decline of the West. I'd be curious to see your thoughts, as just in the last decade we've seen such an emergence there in an economic fashion. Yeah. And now the talk of China certainly has been a superpower for many years, but now the discussion, the real discussion, is about China's supremacy versus a country like the United States as a sole superpower.
Well, I think there's three things. One, China can't square the circle of free market capitalism with authoritarian government because the freedom that's inherent in making economic decisions under capitalism is often antithetical to authoritarianism. And as everybody knows, I just heard a lecture 2 days ago from a prominent Chinese economist. They are facing enormous problems on the environment, on allowing people who are voiceless to be not only voting and express themselves but have access to a transparent internet, for example, or email. 400 million Chinese have never been to a Western doctor, and their economy is actually slowing down. So they've got some enormous problems. Still, one American produces three times the goods and services as do three Chinese workers today. So it's still a matter of degree of them catching up, not a parity. And we'll see how well they deal with trying to liberalize their political system to match their economic liberality. The second thing is that we go through these fits. If you and I were having this conversation in the 1930s, Charles Lindbergh would be assuring us that Germany had squared the circle and that they had brought new elements of race, government, and industry to create a new national socialist man. If we were talking about Japan or Italy, the same would have been true. The superiority of fascism, getting the trains running on time while we were mired in a depression. Had we had this conversation after World War II, people on the left, not the right, would have said, wow, communism is sweeping Asia. It's sweeping Eastern Europe. It's just got a better paradigm. You know, everybody gets to share. There's no selfish people. It imploded. If we had this conversation in the 70s, people would say Japanese incorporated. They've married government and big corporations. They bought Pebble Beach. They bought Rockefeller Center. The Honda is superior to GM, et cetera, et cetera. And we know how Japan's got terrible problems today. I could ditto this with the EU. In the 80s and 90s, the euro was the wave of the future. So we go through these periods, but it's very hard to better the American system because, A, it's multiracial. It's got a wonderful constitution. And it creates a meritocracy rather than a tribal system of evaluating talent. So if you go to Silicon Valley, as I do each week, you see people from India, Pakistan, Africa, Korea, China, Japan, Eastern Europe, and they all have one thing in common. Somebody is going to be paid or promoted based on his talent and not the color of his skin or who his first cousin is. If you look at the top universities, the Times Education Supplement just rated the top 400. Of the top 20, 18 were American. 5 were in California, more than any other single nation other than the United States. If you look at our armed forces, it's still bigger than the next 25 militaries. If you look at agricultural exports and productivity, we were told that we would be importing food by now. People said that just 20 years ago. We're the largest food producer in the world. So we have terrible problems fiscally with our fiscal situation, our debt and deficits. We have racial tensions, but it's always compared to what? What's the alternative? And if we look at education, agricultural production, fuel production, constitutional stability, social cohesion, the United States has enormous advantages over Europe, Japan, China, the Arab world, South America.
Our guest is Victor Davis Hanson today. A few years ago, you published your first novel. That was a different sort of thing for you. What are you working on now after this
book? Working on a book with a very depressing title called The End of Everything. And it tries to ask the question, when two sides go to war, why in very rare occasions across time and space of the last 2,500 years does one side destroy the enemy? I mean utterly, Armageddon. Why did the Romans not just defeat Carthage in the First and Second Punic War, but after those in the Third wipe out Carthage? There's no Carthaginian language today. Why did Belisarius not just defeat the Vandals of North Africa but destroy them? Why did Hernan Cortez not just defeat the Azteca, but destroy the city, destroy its culture? Why did the Ottomans destroy the very nature of Byzantium? Or the Mughals go in and forever annihilate the very idea of an Arab caliphate, which bin Laden used to dream of all the time? And so what are the situations? Was it honor? Was it these very sophisticated societies had found themselves vulnerable? Had they miscalculated what the war was about? So I'm trying to find as a philosophical question, and obviously this is very relevant for the present because while most wars do not end in annihilation, every once in a while something like the Iranian-Israeli dispute comes on the scene where one side or both sides will have the ability to annihilate one another. And they have the desire to, they have the pretext to, and if they have the capability to, that would be something that would be quite scary in our own time.
We've been talking with Victor Davis Hanson. He's the author of the new book, The Savior Generals, How Five Great Commanders Saved Wars That Were Lost. It was published earlier this year. Victor, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment and talk about the California dream. Is it alive and well, and where is it alive and well? We'll talk to Joe Matthews of Zocalo Public Square and learn his thoughts. Also, local technology entrepreneur Jake Soberall will join us and talk about the process of growing jobs and growing community here in the San Joaquin Valley. It's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition.
The news doesn't stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, co-hosts for Here and Now,
your source for comprehensive news, information, and interviews in the middle of your day.
We're combining the resources of NPR and WBUR Boston to bring you stories that will keep you up to date.
Entertain you with features and music.
Join us Here and Now.
Listen Monday through Thursday from 11 to 1 p.m. on Valley Public Radio.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Is the California dream dead? For many in coastal California, sky-high real estate prices and traffic gridlock suggest that may be so. In this radio version of his Connecting California series, Joe Matthews of Zocalo Public Square says that California's future is all about cities like Visalia and Fresno.
Are you a young person in a pricey coastal city who fears the California dream ended a few generations back? Do you see no end to your struggles with high rents and a sluggish job market? Here's some advice. Go inland, young Californian. Yes, this may sound like strange advice. Yes, inland California, especially Southern California's Inland Empire, was ground zero for the housing crash. And yes, inland California has some of the state's dirtiest air, most dangerous streets, and highest jobless rates. But all that damage has also created opportunity. The inland region is awash in affordable homes. Skilled workers are in demand. According to the job service Bright.com, one of the places in California with the most job openings is Fresno, where jobs abound in retail, professional services, and healthcare. And concerned policymakers on the coasts, including foundations and charities, are spending more on the inland region. It's no accident that Highway 99 is bigger and better than ever, and that high-speed rail begins in the San Joaquin. Of course, inland California remains a hard sell. When I Googled, "Why should I move to Fresno?" the first link that came up was an article, 10 Reasons Not to Move to Fresno. But the cost of living is low, traffic is mild by coastal standards, and the physical beauty of the valley is underappreciated. If I were younger, I'd think hard about moving to Visalia, population 126,000, about 45 minutes south of Fresno. Visalia has its own symphony and opera. Its downtown combines old-school charm and new-school functionality with enough ethnic food options to satisfy even an L.A. hipster. The minor league baseball team, the Visalia Rawhide, is run with major league style. On a recent visit, I saw a three-bedroom, two-bath, 2,100-square-foot house for sale in a spotless neighborhood for $179,000. And you get more than you pay for. In a recent survey, 69% of Visalians rated the quality of life in town as either high or very high. But what's most striking about Visalia and other small California cities is the relative openness of the people in charge. In L.A. and the Bay Area, elites hide in the hills and behind walls. Public policy gets decided by power brokers behind closed doors. By contrast, when Visalia decided whether or not to go to the ballot to raise the local sales tax, the city formed a blue ribbon task force and opened membership to everyone. Some 38 people joined. When the group finally decided against recommending a tax increase, commission co-chair Janice Avila disagreed with the conclusion, but told the local paper, "This process was phenomenal." On a recent morning, I found myself on the south side of town at a groundbreaking for yet another health clinic in Tulare County. The executive with the shovel said, "Rome wasn't built in a day. If it was, we would have hired the contractor." Inland California won't be built in a day either. But move now, and you can get in on the ground floor.
Made up my mind, make a new start. Going to California with an aching in my heart.
That was Joe Matthews of Zocalo Public Square, and Joe Matthews joins us now on Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Joe, welcome to our program.
Great to be with you, Joe.
Joe, your commentary, we posted it on our website a few days ago, and it's generated just a ton of hits and a lot of different comments from people throughout the Valley. I think it's interesting because you're based in Southern California, but you spend a lot of time here with Zocalo Public Square and your job, and you offer an interesting perspective. I think a lot of times the Valley, we go between two different extremes, one civic boosterism and then the other the self-loathing. And I think it's interesting to hear your perspectives on this issue. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, I mean, I've been coming up to the Valley my entire life. My mom's family is a big family of Okies, so you know I know most of the stops on 99. And I just was struck by I had to spend a lot of time in my role as a Zocalo editor looking for people to write stories in the Valley recently, and I was struck by how much better things looked actually than in 07, 08. And then I came across some data that some folks at a company called Bright.com had put together that showed a lot of huge number of job openings on a per capita basis, very high number in and around Fresno. It was sort of by their calculations, the second easiest place to find a job, and of course that weighs heavily to certain jobs where having education is pretty important. But that there was sort of an opportunity there, and you know, we in Southern California have that same extreme and swing between civic boosterism and thinking that places has gone to heck. And I mean I sort of look at the Valley both now and in long term as like that neighborhood with a lot of potential next to some neighborhoods that are doing better in the big sweep of California. And it's still the place where kind of the cost of entering, of buying a house, of getting involved, of rising in a community to influence and importance are what they used to be in California. It was those barriers and costs are pretty low. So I think, if good things are done, if the state and people in the Valley make good decisions, the Valley is probably the best investment in the state.
Joining us now also in our studio, we have Jake Soberall. He is the CEO of Bitwise. He's a local technology entrepreneur and also a boomerang himself. He left Fresno, came back to the area. How many years ago, Jake?
Almost 4 years now.
And you've just launched some big plans, which we'll talk about in just a moment. But, Jake, I wanted you on our program today because you have a really interesting perspective on this jobs thing. You've been a part of this project called the Boomerang Project. That's something that Creative Fresno and the mayor of Fresno, Ashley Swearingen, have put together, and it's trying to bring back folks who grew up in this area, went off to get their education, have high skills now, and to try to bring them back to fill some of these jobs that are going unfilled. And when that issue came up, we heard a lot of the same sorts of comments that we're seeing about Joe's article now, saying, like one person, DB, posted on our site, "I'd like to know about all of these jobs. Where are they?" Because we do have this area that's high in employment. There's a disconnect here. Jake, what have you seen in that area?
So there's a couple things that are important to recognize. One is that there are a lot of people having a lot of hard times out there, especially in Fresno. But with that, there are a lot of opportunities in Fresno, and there is this gap of sorts because the sorts of opportunities that are available oftentimes require experience, high levels of education, and those go unfilled in Fresno because our population as a whole lacks a lot of those talents or at least a surplus of them. And so employers wind up looking for that candidate for a long period of time, and the jobs go unfilled whereas in other places they might get scooped up much more quickly. An important thing that we found with the Boomerang Project that I didn't expect or know about before I got into it, though, is that we as the employers also do a pretty poor job of communicating our opportunities, of getting it out there and recruiting candidates. And so as a result, the employer is partially to blame too. So I can understand some of DB's angst there with where do I find this? It's not as I sometimes tease that it's a backdoor jobs market in Fresno, and you really have to get out there and build the personal relationships. The Boomerang Project for folks who have left Fresno and might want to come back is trying to break down some of those walls.
One of the things that Joe Matthews talked about towards the end of his piece is this openness, or I like to say it, access to whether it's government or in the business world or things. I like to say that the Valley in some ways is a frontier area still, for better and for worse, with all of the connotations that goes with that sort of saying. But I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, Jake. You've become very involved not only as an entrepreneur but also civically, and I think that's something that younger people in this area can do if they choose to, that they maybe couldn't do in Silicon Valley or in Southern California.
It's so true. I went to the University of North Carolina and have friends who decided to settle in Manhattan and Los Angeles and other places. And I give them a hard time because the meetings that they're fighting to get invited to, I'm leading in Fresno. And so the opportunity to connect at a high level at a very young age here in Fresno is really, really astounding. It's a scary thing, but it's also an exciting thing. If you're a young, ambitious person with talent and something to bring to the table and you realize you've got something to learn, you're going to be able to do that a whole lot faster here in Fresno than you would in any other place. And so for many of the reasons pointed out in the article and for this reason of accessibility, I think it makes it very attractive if you're willing to say, look, I'm going to be the one who goes out and chases down the opportunity, because you're going to have an opportunity to do the sorts of things you want to do much sooner in your career.
Joe, one of the things you talked about in your piece towards the end was Harvard MBAs working in Hollywood mailrooms. You know, the California dream is something our parents talked about and is part of our state's legend and folklore. Is it still alive and well in Coastal California? I mean, economies are booming, jobs are there, technology, entertainment, all these things are still very vibrant to a degree. What are your thoughts on that in terms of moving up?
I think there's a lot of California dreaming available. I think in the sense in which my family came, my mother's family from Oklahoma with, some of them had high school education, some didn't. My father's family, via the Navy, There was an opening for people in sort of the bottom rung who were young and didn't have a lot. My grandmother showed up barely with a high school education from Oklahoma in Southern California, and ended up in ultimately doing the electrical wiring for the space shuttles. I mean, it's without ever adding to her store of degrees, that ability to go from the bottom and build a middle class, even upper middle class life. I think that's gone. But I think there can be a bigger dream, and big part of that dream working in your part of the world has to do with education, both the K-12, but really higher education. You need more of that. I mean, a lot of talk about high speed rail, but I would argue that UC Merced is the biggest thing that's happening in your neck of the woods. And one thing I left out of the piece, sort of a cautionary note, I should say, that an editor cut it out for length, was, in talking about Visalia, is that the biggest threat to Visalia right now is the problems of their community college, the College of the Sequoias, which has real accreditation issues. That's a serious issue. That when you drill down into Tulare County and how it works, and that college is a big important part of the picture. If I were an economic development official, I would, certainly wouldn't turn down high-speed rail, but I'd certainly wonder if I couldn't, find that kind of money to invest in higher education, opportunity, infrastructure in the San Joaquin.
We're talking to Joe Matthews of Zocalo Public Square. He writes a column called Connecting California, which appeared on our website recently in a piece called Go Inland, Young Californians. Jake Soberall, a technology entrepreneur here in Fresno, also joins us. He's a I should say, younger entrepreneur, I guess you could say, in the Valley, who's a boomerang who came back to the area in which he grew up and is now doing some exciting things. Jake, I want to ask you about being an entrepreneur in this area and specifically doing technology. This is something that the Valley hasn't always there's been a technology industry here, but I don't know that we've talked about it as much as other places. And now you're trying to do some things. You've opened up a technology hub that has about 8 different companies in downtown Fresno. What exactly are you doing with Bitwise?
So Bitwise Industries, there's really two sales pitches. On the one side, for folks from the non-technical background, we're trying to create an ecosystem to support the continued growth of the software industry in Fresno. And so that means a number of different things. If you're on, and I'm learning that this is a perfectly appropriate, if not a admirable term, if you're on the geek side of things, we're trying to build a Googleplex in Fresno that makes this a world-class place to do technology. And so what we saw, the founders of Bitwise, is that there is tremendous technology talent, technology energy, and there's really exciting things going on in the technology industry here locally in Fresno. But it's disconnected. Nobody's taken the time to say, let's consolidate it, connect it, and then help it grow together. And so that's what we've set out to do at Bitwise. And you alluded to the fact that we have now launched in 1 month. We've been open for 4 weeks. We launched Bitwise Mural District, which is a technology hub in downtown Fresno, and it's home to 12 technology companies, each doing exciting and different things as good as they get done any place. And they're doing it in downtown Fresno, just kind of as a demonstration of the level of activity and excitement in that industry. We opened the doors to Bitwise Mural District on day one. On day three, it was completely leased out, all 12 companies. And it's not an incubator. It's not a charity. These folks are paying market rate rent because they wanted so badly to be around one another and to be able to do technology in the way they do in the Silicon Valley.
Is that isolation a part of the challenge here? When things so spread out, a technology company way over here in this part of town and another part of town over here, and they aren't, technology people like to be together and exchange ideas?
Absolutely. Well, I'd say that it's not that they don't want to exchange ideas. It's just there's never been that meeting place. Anecdotally, there is a company in town called Decipher. They're an international company that's headquartered in Fresno doing exciting technology things. I was visiting with a smaller technology company that's literally 2 blocks from Decipher here in Fresno, and they had never heard of Decipher. And that's astounding to me that in an industry as relatively small on a global scale as technology is in Fresno, these companies blocks apart hadn't heard of one another. And so what Bitwise is that opportunity to put these smart people in the same room and watch them flourish in the same way they have in other places.
And in terms of the economy here, we have this education gap. We have these jobs. We have a lot of people who unfortunately don't have the skills that match up with those jobs. Are you, your companies you're working with, seeing that disconnect continuing, or is it a matter of bringing in people from the outside? How is that working in real life for you?
Well, we've set out to cure just that problem. We want to build an army of geeks, if you will, here in Fresno, and geek means software developer or technologist in this context. So we've launched what's called Geekwise Academy. That's where in 6-week increments we'll teach you how to take these jobs in the technology industry. We'll teach you a hard skill. There's no fluff, no theory, none of that. We've built courses around what employers in Fresno, for all of these jobs that DB and others are wondering about, we've built courses specifically to that. In 6 weeks, we'll get you ready to enter the industry. So Geekwise Academy is a company we've launched and is there at Bitwise Mural District now.
That's a very interesting story, and we thank you again for joining us today. We've been talking with Jake Soberall of Bitwise. He's the CEO of this new technology company in Fresno and been part of the Mayor's Boomerang Project. Also joining us on the phone today with his commentary, Joe Matthews, editor of Zocalo Public Square. You can find his Connecting California column on our website and throughout a number of different publications and online sites throughout the state. Joe Matthews, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
And you can comment on Joe's piece on our website, kvpr.org. Look for the link, Go Inland, Young Californians. That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, and follow us on Twitter @kvpr and @Valley Edition. Also on Facebook, Valley Public Radio. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.